Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Yusuf Ibrahim, who is a columnist and political risk consultant. He served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for The New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for The Wall Street Journal. In 2003, he formed the consulting company Strategic Energy Information Group in Dubai, and he has an article at The New York Sun as Washington dithers, Arabs rally to Egypt's revolt against political Islam. Welcome to Background Briefing, Yusuf Ibrahim.
Hello.
And the money's pouring in from the Gulf. The Saudis were the first to congratulate the military coup in Egypt. $12 billion is flowing in. Suddenly, gasoline, as you mentioned in your article at the New York Sun, there was a standard four-hour wait for gasoline in Egypt. And suddenly, overnight, all of the shortages have gone, including gas and bread. So, well, let's start with that question. To what extent did the Saudis and the other Gulf monarchs undermine the government of Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood government of Morsi in Egypt, through economic sabotage? And are they consequently rewarding the military government now?
Well, to the degree that there was economic sabotage, it was coming from inside Egypt, from the opposition to Morsi, which included, of course, many elements of the ancien regime of Mubarak, but genuinely a huge number of the people, many of whom stopped going to their jobs, and, of course, the Islamists were cutting off many roads and sabotaging their opposition. So in the process of this back and forth, basically the productive element in the country stopped working. I mean, factories were shut down, the private sector stopped pumping money, tourism just about died, which is tourism is a major source of income and a major source of employment for each tourist. There are like four Egyptians working directly in hotels or in support system. So, in fact, the sabotage was due to the Egyptian revolution, which began, 2 years ago, continued and intensified in the year Morsi was president. Now, there is no question that Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates in the Persian Gulf region were very worried about the Muslim Brotherhood because they have it in their own backyards. In fact, on the very day that Morsi was removed from power, July 3, the United Arab Emirates indicted and sent 61 people, doctors, engineers, both Egyptians and UAE citizens, to jail between 10 and 25 years for being members of the Muslim Brotherhood plotting a coup there. So there was a lack of sympathy for the Muslim Brotherhood in the neighborhoods of the Arab oil-rich countries, and there was a complete opposition to it by a substantial number of Egyptian people. Now, on the other hand, Iran, of course, didn't know what to do with this revolution because it was a revolution it liked, but in the same time, it was viciously anti-Shiites. And a few days, indeed, before the revolution, four Egyptian Shiites were massacred and dragged through their bodies dragged through the street. So Iran was there, but wasn't there. And the picture was strong opposition supported by rich countries, but on condition they do something. And, of course, the military. Basically, the military said to the rebellion movement, you show us that you can put people in the street, and we will come out and do what they have done.
And do you think, though, that the people on the street, the liberals, the revolutionaries, the socialists, the secular, who brought about the original revolution 2 years ago, are they being used by the military who will, in fact, not turn over power to a more pluralistic group of Egyptians, including those that brought about the first revolution and the second revolution?
Well, I think, Ian, we're kind of past that point because the military did stay in power immediately after the overthrow of Mubarak. First, they acquiesced to the overthrow of Mubarak. In other words, they encouraged him to leave. And then they took power and discovered in the year they were in power that they really had become very unpopular, and the army is very sensitive to that. I do not think they are looking forward to a repeat of this experience, and they did, in fact, rush very quickly to enunciate a plan of action, which includes writing a new constitution instead of the Muslim Brotherhood constitution, which was completely biased toward Sharia law, etc. And they said they were going. This was going to be followed by parliamentary elections and then presidential elections. We have their word for it, but I tend to believe that they really mean it this time because they appreciate that while they can supervise a fundamental change in the way things are going, they cannot and don't want to be bogged down in a day-to-day management of the country. But there is another element at play here. There is a real explosion of jihadist terrorist activities in the Sinai Desert, which is engaging the army. Now, the army was the total support of Israel next door, is moving a very large number of armed vehicles and troops and commandos into Sinai to battle what's becoming an assembly of jihadists coming from everywhere. There are Lebanese in there, Syrians, Afghanis, Turks, and so you don't really want the Sinai to become a mini Afghanistan. So the army is busy. It's too busy to really stay in power.
Again, I'm speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who is a columnist and political risk consultant. He served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for The New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for The Wall Street Journal. In 2003, he formed the consulting company Strategic Energy Information Group in Dubai, and he has an article at The New York Sun, "As Washington Dithers, Arabs Rally to Egypt's Revolt Against Political Islam." Let's turn to the broader Middle Eastern manifestation of this revolt against political Islam in the form of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Morsi government. You say it's happening throughout the Middle East and that Qatar was the main champion of the Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt, in particular, who they subsidized to the tune of about $10 billion and who Al Jazeera network that they own, that they pumped $30 billion into, that became a mouthpiece for the Muslim Brotherhood. We know that Erdogan in Turkey is also a Muslim brother, and that the Free Syrian Army fighting in Syria are largely made up of Muslim brothers. We know that King Hussein has his problems with the Muslim brothers in his country. So give us a sketch of who's up and who's down in terms of those that support the Muslim Brotherhood up until this counter coup.
Political Islam is not a new phenomenon. It started immediately in Egypt, since the establishment of the Muslim Brotherhood, all the way back to 1928. They had their battles with the king, King Fuad first and King Farouk second, and then after army officers overthrew the king and Nasser came as, the new leader of Egypt. They attempted to assassinate Nasser in 1954, and the Egyptian military engaged them in the most ruthless manner, imprisoning thousands of them and employing very rough methods in treating them. So basically, you're looking at a movement that grew, that continued to grow despite this massive arrest and persecution and retaliation, actually, as an underground movement. They have no knowledge of how to operate as a government, just like the army we were talking about a minute ago. In the same way, both groups know how to make secret plans, how to launch attacks, how to launch operations, but they don't know how to manage a system that falls in their lap. And the Muslim Brotherhood had struggled for 8 years to take power and then managed in 1 year alone in Egypt to lose it. It is not a coincidence that the political Islam across the Arab world is shaking and crumbling. It is not, of course, it got quite a shock from what happened in Egypt, but it was already crumbling. I mean, Hezbollah, which is essentially a political Islamic movement, and Hamas in Gaza, which is essentially an extension of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, have had a very disappointing record in the past 10 years. I mean, Hezbollah, which stands for Resistance Against Israel, has been, in fact, fighting and killing Arabs and Muslims in Syria. It has kidnapped, hundreds of people inside Lebanon. It has terrorized Lebanon. And it has done very little fighting with Israel. Same thing with Hamas. I mean, it just basically instituted an Islamic State in Gaza, ruptured the Palestinian movement, and put on hold any aspirations of Palestinian state. So people are looking at this and saying, what has political Islam done for its people and then for the wider Arab nation? In Algeria, going back all the way to 1992, when the army stopped an election that gave the upper hand to the Islamists, who were the Muslim Brotherhood, in fact, they went into guerrilla warfare, and it lasted for 10 years, and well over 80,000 people were butchered. And, of course, the army prevailed. So the defeat and the challenge of political Islam has been a running story for 20 years. It is now coming, I think, to a climax. And it is the climax appears to be not in favor of the Islamic movement. I cannot imagine any scenario under which ex-President Morsi can come back to power in Egypt. And I cannot even imagine a scenario under which the Muslim Brotherhood, which has anyway refused to participate in government, can play a political role, which means they're going to go back to the underground work, which is only going to make things worse for them. Same thing is happening in Syria after 2 years of civil war in which Bashar al-Assad appears as a real monster. The works and the terrorism inflicted in Syria by the opposition group, which calls itself the Free Syrian Army, which is basically composed by extremist elements of Muslim fundamentalists, and the Brotherhood again has massacred villages. There were some horrible scenes of opening a chest of a Syrian soldier, ripping his heart out and munching on it. It has, again, disappointed, and people are wondering, are we supporting these extremists to oppose Bashar? It's a choice between two poisons. But while Bashar was the bad guy all along, he is now seen as a lesser bad guy than the Muslim Brotherhood. In Lebanon, the same feeling prevails, as you pointed out, in Jordan as well. I mean, the Islamic political Islam is tantamount now to civil war and financial ruin, and people are beginning to react to that.
So Yusuf Ibrahim, again, a columnist and political risk consultant for 18 years, senior regional Middle East correspondent for The New York Times, and 6 years as energy editor for The Wall Street Journal. Within political Islam, there's the Saudi version of political Islam through the Wahhabis and that relationship that the royal family has, where in effect it uses religion as a form of repression, where the royal family behind the walls can live incredible opulence and Western-style living, but the average Saudi is whipped into shape by the ubiquitous religious police. And that's one model, which seems to be a very reactionary model that maintains monarchies. And if the government owns your body, then they already have your mind because you're so busy trying to live under these onerous religious strictures. So that's one version. And then you've got the Qataris next door supporting and financing the Muslim Brotherhood. And my understanding is that a recent meeting of the Syrian opposition in Doha, the Saudi delegation and the Qatari delegation were screaming at each other because they don't support the same people. But what is the difference between the people that the Saudis support, the al-Nusra people, and the people that the Muslim Brotherhood people that the Qataris support?
Actually, there isn't much of a difference. And I was going to say at some point, thinking it's when you were asking the question, the fact is that the difference between Qatar and Saudi Arabia is a difference of ego. Saudi Arabia considers itself the mother of the Persian Gulf Arab monarchies, and Qatar is this tiny little place whose native population of 250,000. Saudi Arabia has 22 million people, and of course Egypt on the other side has a mammoth 90 million people, but the issue between Saudi Arabia and Qatar is almost personal. When Qatar started its Al Jazeera, which is very powerful propaganda tool that's now in Arab, that started in Arabic and now is in English, and in fact is about to start in the United States of America because Al Gore sold him his network license for $500 million. So they're going to start spewing their propaganda in English in every city in the United States. Are exactly the same as the Saudis. They both believe in the Wahhabi, extremely reactionary form of religion. The difference between them is simply that Saudi Arabia says, "How dare you? We are the big daddy." And the Qataris say, "Oh yeah, well, I'm going to show you what I can do." And they have been very effective undermining the Saudis with Al Jazeera, and the Saudis responded by their own network. So it's been a war of egos and a war, practically speaking, a tribal war among two Bedouin communities. However, within Saudi Arabia, which is, of course, a much more evolved model economically and at this point socially, there is a division about this. I mean, a lot of Saudis, including half the royal family, believe enough is enough of this espousing of this Wahhabi creed, and we want to modernize Saudi Arabia. We want to let our women participate in our economy. We want to, have our schools more advanced. And in the early years of schooling, we want mixed sexes between girls and boys, and so on and so forth. So there is a strong liberalization wind coming from within the Saudi royal family. There is no such thing in Qatar. And that, again, is reflecting itself on who's supporting what in Egypt. A lot of the religiously fanatic members of the royal family are pumping money into the Muslim Brotherhood. Qatar is only pumping money into the Muslim Brotherhood, but there is another wing in Saudi Arabia that is pumping money to Egypt, and they deployed in a big way, 10 days ago, when they immediately announced a grant to Egypt of $5 billion. Kuwait came up with $4 billion, and the United Arab Emirates with $3 billion. That's in grants, food, gasoline products, et cetera, and cash. Of this money, the 12, there's $3 million in cash, which is a grant. So this reflects those people in those countries who have had enough and are saying enough is enough of this holding us back with an exhausted, tired model of Islam of the 7th century. We really need to join the modernization trend in the world. They are held back in Qatar by the whole regime, but in Saudi Arabia by the conservatives. On the whole, however, it seems that the modernizing trend has triumphed. And so in Egypt, it's an opportunity to gain a huge power. Egypt, after all, is the largest Arab country. It has always been the fountain of intellectual and creative arts, cinema, plays, books, you know, writers, and so on and so forth, and ideas, essentially. And it was lost for years between the revolution and Morsi, and now it's coming back, and the Saudis progresses, and the Kuwaitis and the UAE thought, well, let's get Egypt into our camp now, because we can really have a strong backer behind us.
Well, Yusuf Ibrahim, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who is a columnist and political risk consultant. He served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for the Wall Street Journal. In 2003, he formed the consulting company Strategic Energy Information Group in Dubai. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the California prison hunger strike over solitary confinement with someone who spent 410 days in solitary confinement in an Iranian prison.